Yes. Good morning and welcome to the July 10th, 2017 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices you may have with you today. Today's meeting is a study and business session, with the study session starting this morning at 10 o'clock and the afternoon business session possibly starting at 1 o'clock or sooner if we can get through a light schedule today. We welcome the public's input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come to the microphone to speak. Please state your name and address for the record. Today we have a quorum with four commissioners present. Commissioner Smith has been excused. All the customary staff members are here today, including the General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, sitting in as Clerk of the Board Lisa Sanders, and Teresa Boucher. We'll start our meeting today with a Pledge of Allegiance and a Safety Minute led by Mario Cantu.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, Mario Cantu. Education and Community Engagement Coordinator, Chelan County PUD, and I'm in charge of the Safety Minute this morning. So July is UV Safety Month, and I'm going to be sharing some information related to that. Most people are not aware that skin cancer, while largely preventable, is the most common form of cancer in the United States. More than 3.5 million new cases of skin cancer are diagnosed annually. By following some simple steps, you can still enjoy your time in the sun and protect yourself from overexposure. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, recommends these action steps to help you and your family be sun safe. Stay in the shade between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. The sun rays are strongest from mid-morning till the afternoon. Try to stay away from the sun during these peak hours. Use screen with SPF 15 or higher. The broad spectrum protects you against overexposure and to the ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B rays. The FDA recommends using sunscreen that are not only broad spectrum, but also have a sun protection factor SPF value of at least 15. Protect your eyes. UV rays can also penetrate the structure of your eyes and cause cell damage, so wear a hat or sunglasses with 99 or higher UV block protection to protect your vision. Use extreme caution near reflective surfaces or at high altitude. Water, snow, and sand, even the windows of a building can reflect the damaging rays of the sun. That can increase your chance of a sunburn, even if you think you're in a shady spot. Also, you can experience more UV exposure at high altitudes because there is less atmosphere to absorb the UV radiation. Be safe and protect yourself from UV rays this summer. And then I want to share a little fun fact. I'm really terrible at reading somebody else's words, so that's why I was a little shaky. But I'll share this with you. This is a little fun fact that we can all do to be safe during the summer. And that is, if your shadow is taller than you are, you're exposed to likely lower UV radiation. If your shadow is shorter than you are, you've been exposed to higher levels of UV radiation. Seek shade, protect your skin and your eyes. Thank you much.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
That was great. Thank you.
Another interesting statistic which I read recently was that the incidence of melanoma is abnormally high in the Seattle and in western part of the state, which doesn't seem logical, other than the fact that because they get sun so seldom, most people don't wear sunscreen. So that has a national average. It's above the national average for melanoma. So we'll start our thank you, Mario. Approval of the agenda. Commissioners, we've been presented with an agenda. Items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any such request for additions to the agenda? Hearing none. Steve, I'll turn the meeting over to you.
Okay, I want to start today with an update on the Leavenworth substation. John Stoll, Terry Rice are going to join me.
Good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities.
And Gary Rice, Project Manager, Engineering Project Management.
As Steve has mentioned, we're here to do an update on the Leavenworth or the Bavarian substation process and where it stands. We'll go through an overview of the substation sites. Since we last met, we've had the opportunity to work closer with our consulting engineer to look at these sites from a feasibility standpoint. No action is requested today. We will continue on with a recommendation, and you'll see that parlay through this presentation. Of course, questions and comments are always welcome. And then lastly, we'll talk about our next steps and the timeline in this process.
Okay, under review, we did meet on March 6th at the board meeting. At that time, we'd been working with our consultant and also the community focus group up in Leavenworth to identify sites, and we had found three sites that had risen to the top. At that meeting, we narrowed that down to two sites, our Site 14 owned by Upper Valley Mend and Site 8A owned by the city. Site 14 was identified as the recommended site at that time, but 8A would be continued to be evaluated just in case there were some issues that were found with 14. We came back at the March 20th board meeting, and we had reviewed power line easements additionally and continued discussions with the City of Leavenworth officials and the owners of the Mend property. Those discussions continued on through the month of April and May as well. And in May, we did come back on the 1st of May. We had found another site that came up for sale. The Chumpstick site is located very near the other two sites, just across the street from Site 8A. And due to its recent availability and also the positive aspects it had due to access, we decided to recommend to evaluate that site as well. The board did authorize purchase of the Chumpstick site to hold it as an alternative and approved it as probably the approved site. Staff then proceeded with the consultant with three sites, the Site 14, Site 8A, and the Chumpstick site. Initially, there were 16 sites identified by the community group. The next slide will show where those 16 sites are. And the consultant moved forward with four sites for analyzing. The reason there's the additional site was we broke the Mend into two different areas. Input from Mend and also adjacent property owners wanted us to look at another site on the Mend property that was very close but may have had some advantages to it. So we did that. The consultant feasibility evaluation ended up recommending the Chumpstick site as the preferred alternative, which was consistent with the Leavenworth focus group and the board endorsements of the Chumpstick site. District staff is here today further recommending the selection of the Chumpstick site as the preferred alternative. Next steps moving forward would include proceeding with permit level design, initiating the conditional use permit process, and further evaluating transmission routing. The next few slides will break down individually each of the sites that was evaluated. This is an overview slide. Each of the circles showing an area that was originally identified by the community focus group. There was a little bit of moving around on those sites as some owners didn't necessarily want to have their property considered for sale as a substation site. But the area that ended up being evaluated was near the 14 and 8A. And the 14 being the Mend site, and you can see there's two boxes shown on the Mend site for evaluation. 8A which is at the intersection of North Road and Chumstick Highway, and then also the Chumstick site, which is also at the intersection of the Chumstick Highway and North Road, but it's on the eastern end. I might also point out on this, we also show transmission. The lighter yellow color is existing transmission lines. The thicker, more pale yellow would be the new transmission routes that would be built to the substations. These are the cost estimates that came right from the feasibility report prepared by our consultant. It's a summary, and you'll see a range there. The reason we still provide a range is there's still components that may cost more or less than what we were able to nail down at this point in the game. Some of those were the an allowance for an access road, groundwater mitigation if it's necessary. One option shows that we could defer installation of one circuit to a point later in time. There were some unknowns as far as trenching and rock excavation. We haven't done a lot of potholing out there, so we needed a little bit of variation for that. The CUP required landscaping, that's the conditional use permit. That's more of a collaborative effort that happens during design or permit level design. So we don't have that nailed down yet. And then, of course, transmission routing. There's some variations that could happen in transmission routing. I tried to summarize it in the middle of the slide with a range to show the different costs. The Chumstick site does show as the cheapest alternative, with the city being the next more expensive and the Mend being the highest cost of all the alternatives. I've grouped each of the sites into a grouping of about four slides and to show an overall view of this of the alternative, and then we'll look at a general arrangement, and then there'll be a rendering that we can take a look at to show what it would look like before and after the substation. So this is the site, City Site 8A, and it's at the northeast corner of Rattlesnake Hill, and the blue lines are the distribution circuits, and they're each labeled with their circuit number. So we have to get four circuits out from every substation, and we show on this how that would happen. We show a transmission one line and a transmission two line. Transmission one line would be coming from the existing substations, and the transmission two line would be coming in from a new route that would enhance reliability to the new substation and also the existing substations.
Gary, it might be worthwhile to point out that that transmission two line was just the original approach that was used and remained consistent throughout the analysis. It's described there, but when we get to the transmission piece, there's options around that.
Yes, and those options are going to be further evaluated with the community to follow. This is a general arrangement of Site 8A. What's common between all the alternatives is we actually show a double banked substation. You see those two lines of transformer switchgear and dead end structures. We would only build one to start with, but we would have room for the second. Each site has to be able to have a mobile substation pulled in with a tractor trailer and turn and park underneath the dead end structure and switchgear area. So you have to be able to pull in, make a loop, and pull out of every substation. So each substation will have a different general arrangement, but this shows how we would accomplish it on Site 8A. This is a view taken last fall at that northeast corner of Rattlesnake Hill, showing just what it looks like without a substation, and the next slide will show what a substation rendering would look like there. So this gives you an idea of what the substation rendering would look like. We showed it just built out with one transformer, one switchgear, but room for a second one. This shows the MEND Site 14, Alternatives 1 and 2. The Alternative 1 was the original plan identified by HDR. The Alternative 2 came after a little bit of collaboration with adjacent property owner, MEND, and input with the city as well. There was a desire over Alternative 1 to move the substation further to the west, which would leave more room for housing development in the future, and hopefully tuck that substation in to where the views wouldn't be quite as bad. When you look at the last two renderings that we have to show the Mann property, you'll see that the alternative number two did accomplish tucking that substation in a little bit better after that community input. So this shows alternative one, where our original plan would be in the substation. The thing to maybe focus on here is how towards the upper portion of the substation, that's where the dead end structures are and the switchgear. That's the area that the mobile sub has to pull into. So we would pull in one access, do a horseshoe, and pull back out. The comment that we got from Mend in the city was, could you tighten that up and somehow keep from having so many tall transmission power lines going to that substation? So in the next slide, you'll see we rotated the orientation 90 degrees and then placed it over a portion of the property that is the West, what's that, West Workout Club there. Anyway, we moved it a little bit to the west and rotated it 90 degrees. You can see in this one, you would pull straight in with the mobile sub and it would park and then again do a horseshoe and come out, but we were able to tuck it in a lot tighter in the, it was Club West, excuse me. And in the renderings, you'll see how that arrangement did reduce the number of transmission poles that we needed to have and left more room for development, for a housing development. So this is a picture before, looking in the direction of where the new substation would go. This is the alternative one rendering. You'll notice the transmission towers coming to the far north end of the substation in this arrangement, and when it rotates 90 degrees and moves into the Club West property a little ways, those transmission towers are able to stay up tighter to Rattlesnake Hill. So this photo is from the same location, but it helps reduce the number of transmission towers that we have. The last site that we analyzed through the consultant was the Chumstick site. This was the lowest cost site. And as John mentioned, the transmission routing is the same for all of the alternatives, with the exception of the Mend site, which takes a little bit more distance of transmission. That helps increase the cost of it. With the Chumstick site, you'll notice it is just adjacent right across the street from the 8A site. Some of the advantages of the Chumstick site is its location right on North Road and the Chumstick Highway, which allows us to pull a mobile sub in off of one existing road and pull it out onto another existing road. This shows a general arrangement with, like I said, one switchgear cabinet transformer built out and the other one remaining for future. You still build both dead-end structures at the same time. It's just missing the equipment for the second application, which would be maybe 10 or 15 years in the future. So what we envision is pulling off of North Road and then taking an immediate 90-degree turn to the left and parking the mobile sub at that location and then exiting with the tractor unit out onto the Chumstick Highway. This is an existing shot of where the Chumstick substation would go, and the next one is the rendering of the substation. You can also on this one see the transmission one and the transmission two coming in from the right and the left. So our plan, next steps and timeline would be take comment at this meeting on the arrangements that have just been seen. And then we would like to go tomorrow night to the Leavenworth City Council meeting, the evening meeting, and talk about our feasibility report, the findings, and the recommendation. And then through the month of July, we'd like to initiate the CUP process and initiate permit-level design. And then July through September, evaluate transmission routing in a combination with stakeholder outreach. Quarter three and quarter four, we could begin major equipment purchases because they do have a long lead time item. I could open it up to any questions you might have.
That was good.
I noticed in the picture from Chumstick, existing There's a transformer and a pole that missing in the rendering. Is that because it'll be shifted over to the substation location?
I think that they thought they would put that underground at the same time as the construction. Right now it crosses the road, but it wouldn't need to afterwards. They also removed the tractor, if you noticed.
Yeah.
I thought that's how you got there.
Good.
Thank
just
you.
Couple comments. I think the newer site has some definite advantages. I mean, just if you see the pull in, the pull out, that's much, that looks great. I think truly the benefit of the Chumstick site is it removes that transmission along Rattlesnake Hill that I think really improves that view and the beauty of that mountain, and I think the community's really going to appreciate that. So I think the third point is just the amount of community engagement that's gone into this is exemplary, and I really appreciate everybody's work on that. And you know, I think we're coming down, you know, people that were for one of the other sites were definitely, you know, they have really, it's hard for them to say that the Chumstick site is not the best site. They just see the obvious benefits to that, and the logic to it just speaks volumes and has really convinced people who are pro one side or the other, that this is a good decision. So that's the word that I'm hearing.
Well, thank you. We appreciate the support and the support from the city and the support from the community group. In fact, I think there might be a couple of members in the audience too. Mr. Bradshaw over there.
Good morning. For the record, Scott Bradshaw, 238 Birch Street in Leavenworth. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to serve on the focus group. It was a great experience, and I really enjoyed the process. It was a good process. Kudos to the PUD for engaging in this process. I'm a retired utility engineer with over 35 years experience in this industry, so I've been around a few times. In that time, I've seen many ways a project like this can fail, and the most common is lack of community support, lack of community involvement. Getting out front like this is a great, great move. The PUD team did a great job in selecting a significant cross-section of the community. Sean was excellent in organizing the meetings and keeping the group on track, which was not hard. I mean, well, not easy considering the group. Chad shined at teaching Substation 101. Many of the group had no concept of the complexity, so Chad did a great job. And I'm almost sorry for saying that I was involved in getting Chad here. So. Gary was a valuable source for explaining the engineering issues, and Tika, in my opinion, had the toughest role. She had to spread the word. My experience is that the more exposure early in the process, the better. She did a great job with the various media and keeping the group informed. The only suggestion I would make in that regard is reach out to the various service groups. Their members tend to be the most active in the community. My dad used to say, make like a honeybee and hit as many flowers as you can. You have the results of the process. I believe you have recommended sites, which I just saw. From a purely engineering and operations perspective, a site on the west side of Leavenworth would have been the optimal. But not from a community perspective. What you've got is really a good mix of both. I understand that you're down to the two sites or three sites. From a purely transmission engineer perspective, in which I was many years a transmission engineer, the Chumsik Highway makes sense. From a distribution perspective, I believe the men's site makes more sense because you can get more getaways out to Titus Road. You're closer to the growth areas of West Leavenworth and the Ski Hill area. And if there's a future need to have an additional substation further west, this will give you closer access to it. There's also a possible roundabout going in at the Chumsik North Road intersection. So be aware of that, so in future planning that you make sure that you guys intervene with the county planning so that when they put that road in, the interchange in, that you can at least get the mobile in and out of that area. Anyway, thank you again for the process. Thank you again for the involvement. And I think that you're going to have a good product out of it. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Yes, please.
Good morning. I'm Debbie West, and my husband and I are the property owners of Club West, the Site 14. And so we'd just like to encourage the commissioners to select the Chumsik site property over the men's site. We feel that our property would be adversely impacted. It would devalue our property more than I think any other personal property owner of the other locations. So I'm just here to encourage the commissioners to, for that reason, and obviously for all of the costs and other practical considerations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comment.
Public comment? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next up we want to discuss business line financial policies, particularly as they affect the retail electric business. A continuation of the discussion. Mark O'Brien, Kelly Boyd will be presenting. Commissioners, hands up. I wait for her to come back.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, actually, Ann's here. Kelly, can I interrupt for a second?
Got, sure.
One thing that I wanted to just bring to the commissioner's attention. So last night we had a problem with telemetry on one of our reservoirs, and it drained, and so we got that fixed, and it's coming back up. But we have about 250 customers that are served by that reservoir. So we're putting out a notice this morning that there can be a problem. You can get contaminants when you go to the bottom of the reservoir. So we're putting out a notice that for those 250 customers that they should boil water for the next 24 hours because we are doing the testing, but it takes, even on an expedited basis, it takes 24 hours to get the test results back. We don't have reason to believe right now there's a problem, but on the other hand, in the interest of safety and caution, we're going to provide that notice, and hopefully things will be back to normal by tomorrow.
Where's the reservoir?
Where's the location?
It's up Old Station, so Lower Sunny Slope Road, Penny Road on the west, Highway 97A on the east, and Wenatchee River on the south to a half mile north of the roundabout.
Okay,
thank you. Thank you, Kelly.
So, good morning again. For the record, I'm Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, and joining me today is...
Mark O'Brien, Director of Strategic Financial Planning.
And we are here As a continuation of our year-long effort almost around updating and extending our financial policies and guidance. So we've already completed the refresh of the district-wide policies and a portion of the business lines with water, wastewater, and fiber already being completed. This is part two of our discussion about integrated electric and diving into one more layer of detail around our integrated electric business line than we have in the past. The reason that we're doing these, refreshing and extending the guidance now, is the time is right, as our forecasts are strong and no immediate action is needed. So this really enables us to get ahead of things. And we do see things coming in the future like distributed generation and electric vehicles and more HDL, all of those things. We really need to go into this next level of detail so that we can have the right policies and the right rate designs of how to be prepared for the new type of customer that we see coming in the future. Concurrent with that rate design questions, too, we'll also dive into the next level of detail around debt. We have our debt philosophies established, but one more level of detail around internal, external loaning, that type of thing. Now is also the time for that ahead of time so that we can be prepared for the future. Do you want to emphasize that it is an iterative process, though? We have a red line to catch everyone's attention. So each one of these steps we go through is a building block for the next step. And so we take that strong foundation, add the next level and the next level. And at the end, it is possible that we get to results where we look at those results and go, that's not exactly working, or we realize something along the way that we learned that we didn't know. And so it's a normal part of this process where, in that case, you would go back to one of the earlier building blocks and update it and adjust your build to make sure that in the end the result is what we intend it to be based on all the knowledge. So there could be some iterations of this as we go along. In the end, we will have that strong structure built upon all these philosophies. For today, we'll give an overview of our financial forecasts, both looking ahead and looking back a little bit for perspective. Review potential retail electric planning guidance that can help establish this next building block. And the metrics and targets related to those that help us recognize early warning signs of the path we want to be on. Then we'll also talk about what's next up in this series. It is information only, and no action is required today. Our goals of the revenue planning guidance that we're building upon are that they enable us to be proactive in our revenue planning. By being proactive, we can manage for small incremental rate action over time if needed, rather than not knowing until something is needed. It helps support a more detailed rate design, again, that next level of detail, so we can ensure our rate design components are as needed with the changing type of customer we see. And these also present early warning signs, that dashboard light going off. If we look in the future and see that we're veering off path, gives us lots of time to take action in advance. And by being able to do that, it does reduce the potential for large rate adjustments. So all those together, all the goals of retail planning, but with all of that, it really is planning. So it does not impact the discretion of the board for ultimate rate decisions in the future. So with that introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Mark O'Brien to dive more into the details.
Thanks, Kelly. This slide here is just a summarized view, looking out 10 years into the future, looking at our current forecast. Again, noting that the forecast will continue to evolve and change as the district takes actions, either through long-term sales agreements, other decisions on investments, capital replacement, etc. But as you can see, the five-year window, our results remain relatively strong, consistent, as they have been the last five-plus years. We continue to pay down debt, continue to manage our liquidity in a strong position. But once we look out beyond that 5 years, we do see some of those metrics weakening. Again, I would note that they're still
relatively strong metrics, but do start weakening. We start initiating some, issuing some debt, and so the debt balances are currently forecasted to start going back up slightly in that five-year window. As we reinvest in some major assets of the district here, again, and also our cover ratio does go down below our current targeted level, which is 2.0. And so we do see the finances weakening, but again, I would note that they remain relatively strong, but again, giving us an early warning sign that we may want to start preparing for those for that occurrence. And just quickly looking back in time, this is looking at the last 5 years, including this year's budgeted expectation. You can see the combined results for the district. They have averaged a little over $90 million per year over the last 5 years, again, enabling the district to put us in a strong financial position going forward. Again, as we look at the associated activity on the retail segment, so this is the retail electric segment of the district, we were operating at a loss of just over $10 million 5 years ago. That has risen by about $10 million is the expectation in this year's budget. Again, and that's driven by the fact that costs continue to grow up. We continue to expand the footprint of our retail electric infrastructure. And again, rates remain unchanged during this time frame. So the revenue streams relatively flat with continued inflationary impacts to costs, additional transmission compliance type requirements being put in place during that time frame. This next slide, again, looks at that forecasted financials for the district, specifically looking at the integrated electric, so all the components that make up our electric infrastructure, from producing the energy at the hydros, marketing that energy external to the district, as well as our own marketing to our retail customer base. And so just looking at these items here, with the market-based activity is really those items, the energy we're selling under market conditions, so our slice contracts, just block sales and trades. You can see over time, those do erode, and this is a margin. So this is the net margin that expected from those. They remain positive. But again, as we shift some of our load to the retail segment and as costs continue to grow through inflation over time, again, those margins begin to tighten up. The cost-based activity is really those long-term contracts. Those are all fixed-based, covering our cost, plus some adders. Those net margins remain relatively stable through the duration. The retail electric component, again, this is that gap that was $10 million 5 years ago, is now about $20. It will continue to grow. Again, this is with no additional actions beyond the current forecast, which has revenues, retail rates remaining flat and unchanged during that time frame. So again, that's driven by continued expansion of services as well as just inflationary cost growth. The other component is really just some non-operating activity that's also associated with the district, interest earnings, things like that. But overall, we can see a slow decline, although it remains positive and strong. It does declined out in that 10-year window. And so this is giving us information to start planning for that future and trying to address some means to better monitor our financials and get some early warning signs so we can be more proactive in how we address those conditions.
So this is one of those slides that breaks every good presentation rule, where it's a ton of information crammed onto a single slide. But it's one of those where I really think it tells a lot in one spot, so it can really help us build our thoughts around this. So as I described, we want to go one more level down into the detail. We've done a lot around this, the bottom line of the district, and our district-wide metrics really help us focus on ensuring we have that strong bottom line. But when we don't look at the components, it's easy for some of the components to get out of whack, and you might not realize it if the bottom line is where you want it to be, but maybe you're getting off path on a couple of the components. So I did want to share kind of my thought process when I look at this slide of why I think it's so valuable and how it makes me think about potential actions that may be out there or what we're doing about the individual line items. And the market-based activity line, again, it is that what's the contribution to the bottom line margin from our market-based wholesale activity. And we can see that that is declining over time. It is the combination when we look into that of both the lower amounts from the price, from the wholesale electric prices, but also costs of going up over time. So the margin is shrinking. So actions that we would take around that over the long term are the things that we're already doing, like thinking about those longer term market-based contracts to shore up that price, making sure we're looking at cost containment of the cost of producing the electricity. So those are the types of actions that we really can do to affect that line item. The cost-based activity, you can see that that line is pretty steady, and it's because as costs change, the cost-based contracts change with that. So it really does have that steady locked-in margin related to those contracts, and those contracts are in place over this planning horizon. So on that one, not a lot of action that we think about needing for that steady contribution to the bottom line. When we look at the retail electric gap line, you can see, as Mark described, that is a line that is the gap is growing because our revenue base there is only growing by our current assumptions by load growth. But then that load growth seems to be pretty close to offset by conservation measures. So that's where the revenue is pretty flat in our planning timeframe, yet our cost base is growing, you know, just additional costs to do business and as we grow our footprint and reinvest in assets. So this tells us this is a line that we want to focus on because maybe that line is getting out of whack with where we want it to be in relation to the others, even though we have a strong bottom line. So that's why we're really focusing in on this one in what we talk about the rest of the presentation. And we just want to make sure that we don't get too reliant on one of the other lines. So should those not turn out to be as forecasted, we're not so far into something that we would have to take large action then to get out of it. And then the other line is just kind of all that other stuff. And you can see it's pretty small and pretty steady. So again, not another one to focus in on at this time. So I did want to just kind of go through that to show why I think this is so valuable. And I think you'll see it influence as we talk through the rest of the presentation.
Thanks, Kelly.
May I interrupt?
Sorry. Sure.
Kelly, I was figuring numbers on this. And what's the other column? What's that composed of, comprised of?
It's kind of a lot of other things on a shared district basis. So when you hear us talk about our internal service system, where it's a common place to collect costs and then allocate it out, this is kind of the end result there. So when we have interest income, that's different than our interest expense. As we manage our debt portfolio, there's a net positive there. Our self-insurance programs, they go up and down of pluses and minuses depending on premiums coming in with claims going out. So it's a whole conglomeration of all the other kinds of activities that aren't really not related to providing the services that we focus in on, and they net to this activity. And Mark, you might want to add to that too.
Basically the non-operating. So if it's not tied to direct operating activity, operating expenses or operating revenues, then it would be identified there and it's just a slight positive margin over time. I would note that we'll probably reference this slide as we go through some examples later in this presentation, and so you can put things in perspective. This slide is really just kind of summarizing what we're proposing would be the guidance that we're looking for related to revenue planning on the electric side. Again, the keys here are revenue planning should manage for small incremental rate increases over time. So that's one of the key focuses going forward. And really looking at those as inflationary type rate adjustments. So that's what we're looking at as far as planning for small adjustments over time. Also noting that since the revenue base is smaller than the cost based, because again, our costs are higher than the actual revenue streams on the retail segment. As we move forward, any increase in cost requires a higher magnitude of increases in revenues to maintain that margin. So that's just a thing to keep in mind. And so that's, with that understanding, we may need to be more proactive in taking action because we're going to be losing ground potentially as those costs grow at a faster percent than the revenue streams. A key focus here is to manage and avoid over-reliance on that wholesale electric revenues. As Kelly went through, those can change relatively quickly going forward, and we continue to monitor those, but that's one thing we need to be focused in on. Another key thing is not to be focused on one single metric. Have these as more of a portfolio of metrics, balancing those metrics, and making sure we're not missing something, as Kelly identified, in various segments of the district. And again, as Kelly mentioned earlier, again, the option to come back and further update and modify these metrics or the targets. Again, that'll be a continuation as things change, as the board takes other actions that maybe impacts our financial results. We'll continue to come back and update those as we learn more. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, the general planning guidance that we're looking to move forward on. With that, we've I've got a few examples of some specific metrics that we're looking at providing that early warning guidance for us, and I'm going to walk through those. These first two are cost-based type metrics, so looking at covering a certain amount of cost, and these kind of mechanically work the same way. They just have a different focus. The first one is really looking at all the costs associated with providing resale service, and then establishing at a target level that we want to maintain. Again, noting that we're not going to be covering all costs, at least in this horizon, but trying to maintain a certain coverage, making sure that we're not getting too far as reliance on that wholesale activity. This would include all costs associated with providing retail service. We would be targeting, you know, something less than our percent. In this case, our initial target would probably be around 65% threshold. I would further note that, you know, we're currently at that 70-75% threshold on our current operations, and we would see that declining, you know, out in the 2023 timeframe is when we'd probably get close to exceeding that or getting greater than the 65%. Excuse me, lower than the 65%. One of the key benefits to have a metric that targets all your costs, it would be a good communication tool to the customer base. I'm having them aware of what the actual cost is and what portion of those of their rates are actually being covered in those costs. The other option is another expense coverage ratio. This is similar to what we're currently using for water and wastewater and fiber. And so on those systems, we're focusing in on just operations, maintenance, and taxes. And again, excluding depreciation would be one of the key things that are being excluded there. And they have targets that are at that 100 or slightly above 100% for those services covering the OMT. So this would, again, we would want to cover a larger share of that subset of cost. But in this case, we would probably initiate a target around 90%. Again, this would not identify all costs, so it might not be as broad as the initial one, the total cost. But again, another way of looking at monitoring our cost versus revenue going forward. And these are both specific to the retail segment. A couple other metric options to look at are really trying to manage the overall gap. And so we're looking at more at, instead of looking at a cost coverage level, we'd be looking at setting a target, maybe a maximum or a threshold that would adjust over time. So once we got to that threshold, they would give us some warning to saying, yeah, we're getting the support or the gap is getting to a certain point where we may need to take action. And so the first one is really just managing the overall bottom line results for retail electric. And so monitoring that gap, we'd probably set a target around $25 million, and that could be adjusted or not adjusted with inflation over time. Again, currently we're at about $20 million is the current gap. One of the key things with these two metrics is these would be more of a threshold or a fixed targeted level. It would not adjust like the expense one. So as expenses went up, they would actually get a higher proportionate amount of support in those on the rates. So these would require probably more advanced action to maintain those thresholds or those targets. Market-based margin is similar, but it's really looking back on that prior slide, looking at that market-based activity, things that we're selling, and as that declines and it gets that support gets greater than $25 million, that would give us a warning that we cannot rely on that revenue stream beyond that point. And again, those targets may evolve over time, but that would be the initial setting of about $25 million. So those mechanically would work similar with just different focuses. The one key thing here is the market-based activity really is just looking at that revenue stream. And so fluctuations in cost may not get picked up on that particular metric, and that's why we would want to use more than one to help monitor the overall financial results. The next couple slides are just some graphical views of the mechanics of how these metrics and targets would work. This first one is looking at those cost metrics.
Hey, Mark, can I interrupt for one second? Because for the board's benefit, I just want you, the thing that we were trying to think through here is what would the board be thinking about? What are the key issues you'd want to be considering if we were trying to move towards incremental rate increases through time? And so as you're walking through this and looking at these, you might think about, so what if we had a proposal in front of us that said, well, so we want to go to 2 to 3% rate increases starting in some year. The question would be what year and what are the things that you would consider? And so you've got some choices here about ways to consider that. I don't think there is one clear way to do this. This is as much art as it is science. And so just might want to put yourself in the mode of thinking about, so what if we had a proposal in front of us? Are these the right things that I'd be considering in making that decision?
Thanks, Steve. Okay. These two examples.
Can I jump in and ask a question? Mm-hmm. Retail electric gap and market-based margin. Is it possible that we could find ourselves with a large change in the spread? We're targeting $25 million, which might require a real volatile rate increase at some point?
There's probably a greater chance of volatility. Again, the actual required action would be decided by the board, but this would just help provide guidance on that.
So to mute that potential for volatility, option one and two would seem to damper that down?
Correct.
And that, it does go around this thought about, we would also want to use the totality of the metrics that we have and the duration maybe of when a metric would get off path and maybe when it would look like it was rebounding. So we wouldn't let just one point in time or one metric necessarily feel like we are forced to make a decision that might not fit into the bigger picture for the longer term. So we really do need to balance all of those, and maybe a couple of these metrics that are more volatile, maybe it's all right for them to pop up and down over short periods of time, and what we're looking for is that long-term path. But mixed with other metrics, maybe that does tell us that we want to take action. So we really do need to look at all of them, of how they work together, and not just let one solo point in time make us feel like we're forced into action. But to help us make those good choices over the long term.
Thanks, Kelly.
So, excuse me, Kelly. So, looking back at the total integrated electric bottom line, so that's a significant decrease from 66 in 2018 down to 15 in 2027.
Yes. So, over the long term, we do see that decrease, and that's why we think now is the right time, before we're experiencing any of that, to put this type of planning guidance in place so that we can change that path at the right timing and do it well in advance so we can do it in small steps over time.
Yeah, so it looks like the biggest contributor to that is the market-based activity, which then affects the retail electric gap.
So it's both of them working independently. Right now we rely on that margin contributed by the wholesale sales to complement the rate revenue we get from retail electric customers. Both of those revenue streams cover the cost of providing that service. So as we look long-term to the future, not only is the contribution from the wholesale electric going down, both from prices going down and costs to produce going up, but at the same time, the retail electric gap is getting bigger. So that's why, looking at the two components, you might not notice until you're pretty far down the road how those are working together. Yeah. And that's why this next level of detail that we're doing right here really provides a valuable early insight that the relationship of those two together might be getting out of whack. And we might want to make choices earlier than we would if we just waited till the total bottom line was stressed to our overall metrics. So you definitely have identified the two lines that we're really trying to focus in on through this activity.
I want to pick up on Kelly's point for a second, too, and just say the totality of the metrics seem really important to me, because you could have that retail margin growing through time, and in fact, we did see that even in the past. But if the wholesale revenues were growing at the same time, then you've got more money to be able to fund it. What's happening now is we're seeing a decline in the wholesale revenues. So as that retail margin grows, and you don't have the same level of growth going on in the wholesale revenues. So you need to look at a couple of different things to decide where is the appropriate time to take action.
Thanks, Steve. So these really just to kind of show the mechanics of how these would work. The red lines are actually just showing the forecasted retail revenue stream. And so that is going up. Again, that's driven by just growth without rate adjustments. We have put in an example of initiating some inflationary rate adjustments starting out in 2023, just to give it some context to what the impact of those revenue streams would be in the event we did do that. And so those will remain consistent over these next couple slides. The blue lines are really what would be considered the requirement and what we would want those revenue streams to cover. And so as long as the revenues are higher than what that requirement is, we would look to seeing that we probably wouldn't need to take action until we got close to that targeted level. And so in the first example is the total cost ratio. And again, this is going to be the least volatile one because it's including all the cost. So as any one cost changes, it's got less of an impact in the totality. And so as you can see, currently in the forecast, we're probably reaching that threshold around 2023 would be a point in time when we're covering, the rates are only covering 65% of the cost. So that would indicate we would probably want to take some kind of action to maintain that, even though we would continue to expand the support for the retail segment. The other example is operating expense ratio, and it's a little more volatile because it's looking at a subset of cost. And actually, you can see that we're relatively close to that targeted level of 90%. In the next couple of years, that's primarily driven by some large O&M from Rocky Reach facility. So that's an anomaly that's occurring. But as you can see, we would meet that threshold in the same time frame, roughly. And so out in 2023, in the event we did do some inflationary rate adjustments, and I think these are at 2.5% expectation as an example, we'd be able to maintain that particular target going forward through that five-year period beyond that. So that's just the mechanics of how those two metrics would be monitored and where they currently are forecasted to be out in the future.
And through this revenue planning, long-term revenue planning guidance, with that guidance being managed to small incremental increases over time if needed, let's use these as an example. The lines cross in about the 2023 timeframe, which would mean that was when you were not meeting your metric. But instead of waiting till 2023, we would have plans in place where we would say, well, maybe we need to start in 2021 or 2020 and do the smaller steps in advance so that we can have those small steps and still get to the same spot by starting earlier rather than waiting till the lines cross. But that's that's just the guidance that we're looking for to ensure that that's the meeting the board needs, and we think it's also being responsive to the feedback from customers of saying that they prefer that those small steps over time. So that's how that comes into play with these graphics too, is we could start the dotted line a little earlier and have the steps be smaller.
So a question I have is, as we go through this maintenance of operation process that we're in now, and we get basically more of our units back online, does the volume that we produce in terms of electricity have any significant play in here, or is it just the price we get continues to decline regardless of the volume we produce?
We factor both into the forecast. So we do have forecasted return to service times. Mm-hmm. And we do adjust the forecast when those plans adjust. Okay. So as well as one can forecast those type of things, we do try to reflect that, because that would be an example of wanting to make sure we didn't make a short-term decision for a long-term situation.
Right.
Okay. It's a great reminder, though, that these are all expected value forecasts.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of variability around these, both on the cost and the revenue side.
And that's what that really small print is at the bottom of almost every slide.
Next examples, again, the revenue forecast is the same example, the expected revenue stream with a what-if inflationary adjustments are triggered out in 2023. These are looking more at those fixed thresholds. The first graph here on the left is a fixed $25 million set in 2017 dollars, so that's adjusted by inflation. So again, the target or the allowance for support to retail is growing, but in line with inflation. And we're kind of fixing that at $25 million. As you can see, out in 2023 is the same time frame when we meet that threshold. Again, this is more of a cap. Even though it's being adjusted by inflation, it's more of a cap. And so a 2.5% inflationary adjustment would not be able to maintain it if you waited until that point in time. So again, you would either need to have a slightly higher adjustment to maintain that threshold or have a more initiate that sooner. You know, a couple years sooner than that, so you would get ahead of that, and you could soften that distance or that the gap over time. The other example is again just fixing it at $25 million and saying that's that threshold. Again, going back to that prior slide 7, our market-based activity gets down close to $20 million as far as the net margin on that. So this would be establishing a fixed limit of $25 million. Again, the volatility on that one would be a little more extreme. Again, since costs are a higher portion compared to revenues, any increase in cost requires a higher percent increase to the revenue. So, again, these are just two examples that we would monitor, again, as an example. Questions on kind of those visuals? The last series of graphs is slightly different here. This is diving into the details, looking at that market-based margin. Again, assuming that $25 million threshold was put in place, you can see the current availability on the first slide. So going back to that slide 7, this is that market-based margin. Currently, that $45 million range, it does decline over the next few years and actually levels out down close to $20 million out in the latter part of the forecast. Again, just kind of putting into perspective where that market-based margin set at $25 million would kind of coexist with the actual forecast, the expected forecast at this point. Again, we always forecast downside scenarios, which would be substantially lower than this current forecast on that slide. The other view is looking at that same market-based margin, that red line, you know, what's available or what are we earning from that market-based activity, and putting that in context to the overall retail gap, meaning the shortfall in the revenues versus the cost. As you can see, it's relatively stable the next several years at around $25 million, 20 to 25 million, but it escalates over time, and that's driven by inflationary cost increases and other investments in the district. So just to put in perspective those forecasts.
And that kind of goes to that reliance, Phil. So if we're relying on the market-based margin to close the gap, you can see that out over time, the gap gets bigger than the amount contributed to it. So that would be over reliance on that volatile line. So that's where this gives us information for early decision making again. The actions are different for each of the line. One line is decisions around managing the wholesale portfolio, and the other line is decisions around managing the retail operation. But knowing how they work together is the relationship that we're building here through this planning guidance.
So really just looking at the next steps related to planning guidance. Again, we're just looking to confirm that this will be providing the appropriate guidance for managing retail electric revenues and making sure we manage those to small incremental inflationary type rate adjustments over time as needed. And this is all, again, to help manage that overall retail gap. We're going to plan to continue to monitor and report on selected metrics during a trial period. Again, monitoring several of these metrics, communicating to the board where we're at as we update and provide quarterly updates to the board. Again, this will be the first step in taking those overall metrics and start assigning, using those to initiate more specific discussions on rate designs. As Kelly mentioned before, looking at distributed generation, charging stations, et cetera, those new types of uses, and even our existing rates, going into more detail on how we would apply those requirements as far as what their rate needs to cover at a more specific granular level. Could be the specific rate class. It could be the rate component, you know, how we actually bill the customer, things like that. So that's the next step, is to start designing those more specific detailed rate design concepts that, again, may be initiated anytime during this window. Oftentimes, we might even have some adjustments that are revenue neutral, but we would be adjusting the rate structure to accommodate these types of new services and uses.
Okay.
Yes.
Say that again.
So we've got current rates that are comprised of, we have rate classes, so residential, commercial, industrial. They have various rate ways we bill the customer. Some of those are, we bill them on a base charge. They have an energy charge. Sometimes they have a demand charge. And so really this overall high-level guidance that we're establishing will be leveraged to then further provide additional discussion and details around detailed rate design on how we set those rates up. For an example, there would be the HDL, which currently did, we established that requirement as a total cost requirement. And so that particular classification, based upon its impact to the district, are covering their cost, even though in the, related to these metrics, we may identify that the overarching rate base only needs to cover 65% of the total cost. But that would be a unique type of a rate, different rate requirements. But they all work together to meet that overall requirement of 65%. Another example would be in the event of initiating other charges or other actions, hookup fees, impact fees, those types of things. Those actually reduce the cost that are required to be covered by the retail rates. And so those are other actions that would take place and discussions that we put in place as part of the overall package of meeting the overall target. And so does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And again, a key thing here is kind of the going back and reading through this process. Again, as we learn more and have more discussion on those detailed rates, we may need to come back and redefine a target or a metric as we learn more, or as we take certain other actions going forward.
And I was going to wait till the very last step, but I think it makes more sense here to kind of reiterate that since this is the first time we're going into this next level of detail. You know, we're not exactly sure that we have the right thresholds, the right metrics. So we want to test them out, test them all out. Steve encourages us to make sure that we test them all out so that we can figure out which ones give us the best information for overall decision making. And maybe in the end, it will be a combination of a few of these examples or something that evolves as we use them. So we are envisioning that we will ask for your guidance or concurrence at the next meeting that we're on the right path here. But it'll be that informal head nod type concurrence that we're on the right path. We will use these as building blocks for the next level, but it won't be anything as carved in stone as a resolution at this point in time, because we're going to try them out first and do the iterative process. And down the road, we would envision them being reflected in a resolution similar to what we have for overarching and the other business lines, but not yet, because we're not there yet. We're not sure we have it just right yet. So I think that's maybe good to reinforce that that's how we envision this kind of rolling out, but it's definitely a long-term effort, and you'll hear a lot more about it before we do think we have it just right.
Commissioner Congdon?
I need to give this more thought, but so how are you going to know when you are really getting off kilter and maybe one of your metrics? So maybe how do you know one metric is really going off the chart? For example, that's right. We're right on line with all the other metrics, and one we're way off in terms of the threshold.
So we will start reporting on these each quarter. So you will see them, not as a because it's a requirement through a resolution, but because it's part of this testing them out. And that's where we'll have that discussion of what we see and what the metrics tell us.
Yeah, I would add that the key discussion will be what type of action will impact those metrics, because each metric will have different actions potentially. And the board may opt to take rate action. They may opt to take other actions. For example, impact fees, for example. That would help offset some of those increased costs that we're incurring right now. substations, for an example. And so that would be an action, what wouldn't be a rate action, but it would be an action that would improve these metrics, or at least some of these metrics. And so that we would bring to the board an awareness of, yeah, we're reaching a threshold in this area, and then bring to the board really what are the actions that would remedy that. And with identifying the incremental rate actions may be one of those actions.
I guess I'm just trying to get at, and I just need to give it more thought. How do we know if these are the right metrics?
I think we will know by testing them out and looking at what they tell us in the totality of overall financial results. So we think we have the relationship of them right from the work that we've done to establish these initial thresholds, but that's where reporting on them on a quarterly basis for the board, we will look at them monthly internally. That will help us see how they do relate to each other in the overall results, and that's how we'll know if we have the right thresholds or not. And then if circumstances change, we may need to change the thresholds as circumstances change. In Steve's example, where it's okay to have a bigger retail gap if you have a bigger margin coming from wholesale sales. So if that was to happen, we would need to adjust. Or if it went the opposite direction and the retail margin was smaller, we would need to change the percentage of reliance to a lower amount so that you more rates covered more of the cost because there was less contribution. So it's really definitely one of those things where you have to look at current conditions and what you see for the long term and try to balance that all together. And that's where it's the balance of all the different metrics. So it won't be kind of an alarm will go off when one thing changes over a threshold or crosses over a threshold. So we really need to put that into the context of what we see over the long term with all of the various metrics.
I just like the feeling of a tool that's been tested to get us into that discussion of forecasting that those future rates or future needs. And so I really appreciate that. I like that rather than being reactive problematically later on and having this provide, in my mind, provides us better explanations of decisions that are being made. So I like that a lot.
Just looking at maybe the potential of a slide that would have if we did a 2%, what would the revenue be produced? 2.5, 3, 3.5. Just so it's just another number that a commissioner has in his head about balancing this and moving it in the right direction.
Yeah, I think that would be part of all of our, discussions related to actions. Mm-hmm. So we would identify, we see something coming, and the potential actions would be to start this year or this other year, and we can use a range of potential actions as far as percent adjustments.
Yeah, so just a little chart would help me.
Okay.
Thank you.
We can include that when we come back next meeting.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting one today.
We could do that too.
I bet you could.
And really, just focusing in on the customer base, we see this as providing some good benefits to the customers. Mm-hmm. I think Commissioner McKinnon just kind of identified some of these in his statement. But really, we're looking to be able to communicate early recognition of when rate action may be necessary or other action. Again, rather than sitting back and waiting and not telling them until we get close to that point in time, this will give them really advanced warning, and maybe it's 5 years in advance, that we will be looking at doing some modest, slight inflationary type rate adjustments. Again, the hope there is to avoid those large rate adjustments that the customer base that don't necessarily like to incur, and it's hard for them to plan for those. Again, one of the key things here is also clearly communicating really what our costs are and really what the revenue rate base is covering. Again, that's a key communication, so they're aware that, there is being support being provided for that service. That support may go away, and it is forecasted to decline. Again, that awareness to them is really important as well. So those are some of the keys, I think, for the customer base as we go forward. And I think this is kind of, as Ms. Commissioner McKinnon identified earlier. So with that, I'll close us up here.
And maybe I'll pause since I already showed my hand a little bit earlier, just in case there are any questions before we just reiterate on the next steps.
Commissioners, any questions?
Well, great. Well, then, you know, just that reminder, we will be back again next meeting. We'll refresh on the information, and we will be asking for that kind of informal head nod of, do we seem to be on the right path? Is this the right thing to use as the building block for the next step? The two next steps are another level of detail on rate planning and another level of detail on debt planning. So this would be the building block, and then we'll keep going. And this will almost seem like a never-ending process, because it really is. We go through, reiterate, and then as conditions change, that would also cause us to change our plans. But as far as putting in these initial building blocks, that we will do the next one at the next meeting, and then we'll break into the two concurrent paths through the rest of the year of the next level of detail on rates and debt. All right.
Good. Thank you. Good presentation.
Thank you.
Yep.
Steve, we're ahead of schedule.
We are. And I think we could knock a few more things out here and hopefully free up some time this afternoon as well, if that's okay.
Okay. Good.
So we'd like to go to manager items. Let me start with Bob, would you like to go first?
We have the phone upgrade?
Yes.
Is that what we're going to talk about right now?
If you're ready.
I'm ready.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you for allowing me to be here. I'm Bob Shane, with the director of the Fiber and Telecom Group. Wanted to give you a very quick update on the phone switch replacement. If we recall from earlier times, we had some challenges in getting this thing launched. Through that process, we redetermined that instead of an upgrade of the system, we went with a full replacement. We reestablished the scope of work, and in October of last year, we started full speed with the replacement of the phone switch. It was a great effort, a lot of collaboration between the technical teams that were involved in making this happen, that being the tech shop, the technicians with the CM group, help desk, and also our employees here at the Chelan County PD that provided a lot of input as to how the system should operate and what those expectations were. We spent a lot of time with special interest groups or special use groups that would be customer service, ops, and other areas that had unique phone needs, and to make sure we understood their full use so that when we rolled this out, we met everybody's expectations. The cutover officially started on the 23rd of June. Worked all weekend long to get that system cut over from the old system to the new system. Monday morning it came up with some errors, but generally the system was operational over the weekend and was in production on Monday. And we're very happy with the performance of the system. We're still working through some detailed problems that we're having it with unique groups, but they're within the scope of what you would expect, fine-tuning the systems, extensions, how phone calls are handled. We did quite a bit on the training side to make sure that our end users were well educated to take advantage of the phone. We've also set up special training groups with those special user groups to make sure that they understood the full use of the system to get the best benefit from that. So it's really, that's all there's really to tell about the phone system. Hopefully you've experienced good phone service. Your handsets should be different in use with the different applications. Couple of the big takeaways for this system is we're using the corporate network to put the system over. So we're finding more use for the corporate network that we already have installed. It's a very powerful system, very dynamic, and we're taking full use of that. With that technology, IP or internet protocol, we can also advance to other advanced call features and services. So Skype for Business is coming shortly. That operates off this platform. That's going to add a lot of additional benefit to the call collaboration process. That's about all I had for the group.
Great. And I wanted to thank Bob and the telecommunications implementation team, at least from the user perspective. the implementation went very smoothly, and I think we're just beginning to enjoy the enhanced features of the new system, and there are more to come. One of the opportunities that was provided by that implementation was an opportunity to improve access for our Spanish-speaking customer owners. So now during business hours, Spanish-speaking customer owners are being directed to Spanish-speaking employees, which is a huge win for us, I think. And after hours, those calls are directed to a translation service, and then either the information from the outage avalanche system is provided to that customer owner, or on an as-needed basis, they are connected with systems operations, and it's a conference call, so the translator stays on the line with the customer owner and the systems ops folks, and make sure that the message and information goes both ways. That has been robustly tested, and thanks to Mario Cantu, this is a big step forward in terms of access for our customer owners who are monolingual in Spanish.
That's great. That's very helpful.
Yep. Very helpful.
Yes. Commissioners, any questions?
Nope.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank
you. Appreciate
it.
Your time. Good job. Yeah. I know there was a lot of effort, and I came in on that Monday morning, and there were some pretty dog-tired tech people walking through the halls, and they'd been here all weekend. So
they did a great job.
They did.
Yeah.
David Lodge was the project manager, and Glenn Copeland was the lead engineer, and they both did a very good job.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, kudos to the team.
Thank you. I'll pass that on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lorna's going to stay. She has another item as a part of a legislative update.
I do. And actually, before I even get to that one, you might have noticed in the Wenatchee World, I think it was on Friday, that Bev Freeman has been appointed to a second three-year term on the Governor's Select Committee on Pension Policy. And so that's really important. She's representing employers on that committee, and that's a really important position. So on the family and medical leave insurance policy, the paid family medical leave insurance policy that passed recently, it will mean a small addition to our labor budgets beginning in 2019. The premium will be shared between the employee and the employer, with the employee paying more than 60% of the premium, unless the employer elects to pay all or any portion of the employee's share of the premium. So we may have a decision to make. There's also a provision in the bill for, they call it voluntary program, which is similar, I think, to our self-insurance program. I need to dig into that a little bit more. But in 2019, the total premium rate is 0.4% of individual wages, and that will be split out as 1/3 of the total premium rate is for family leave benefits. Employers may deduct up to the full amount for family leave benefits from employee wages. And then 2/3 of the total premium is for the medical benefits, and employers may deduct up to 45% of the full amount for that from employee wages. So we'll have some decisions to make somewhere along the way. I presume we'll do those with the budget. And those are just the hard costs. In some ways, I'm a lot more worried about the soft costs of administering this leave benefit, along with all of the other overlapping paid leave laws we have from the federal and the state level. And in fact, various localities, because we have employees who work not just here in Wenatchee, but in other states as well. And there is some fracturing of the environment around localities doing things on their own about paid leave and scheduling and so on. So that's what I have.
Lots of moving parts.
Lots of moving parts. The bill doubled in size very quickly in the last couple of days before it passed. So I haven't fully dug into everything that's in the update, but the update was much better than what had been going through previously before the businesses sat down with the labor leaders and the legislators and hammered something new out.
Key thought is there is something that's going to change for us here, and we need some time to dig into it. We'll be coming back to you in the next couple of months with what the implications are for us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Probably a good moment to go to Sean Seaman for an update on other activities that came out of the end of the session from the legislature.
Well, Commissioner, Sean Seaman of External Affairs Program. The legislature still is in session. They haven't adjourned as yet, but they're not doing much at this point. So we do have some laws that were passed and signed by the governor recently. A lot of these passed or were pushed through in the last moment without hearings. Some of the solar bill really didn't get any hearings. Some of the others changed, like Lorna referred to as this one. They were happening. So we're doing a little, not catch up, but we're definitely still analyzing some of these bills. So of note, there's been an effort to get a renewable energy incentive program extension. There's currently a law right now, and this would extend the renewables, mainly a solar bill. This one, again, was passed late in the session without the public hearings, and the gist of this bill is that it creates a new program for renewable incentives. Of interest, though, this utilities have to opt into this program. And even though they're starting to take applications now as of July of this year, the program's moving over from commerce and administered by utilities to opting to administer through the WSU Extension Energy Program. The incentives will be dropping considerably. There's only a short window to get into the program now. It used to be it was a 10-year window. You can get in late and get reduced incentives, but now you have about a 4 or 5 year window to get into the program, and those incentives are going to drop each year starting now, and eventually by 2021 they'll go down to a much lesser amount. 21 cents now would be the total amount you can get by the time you get to the end of the program. It'd be about 16 cents per kilowatt hour. The other interesting aspects of this, other than the fact that we can opt out, or we have to opt in, they're adding ability for utilities to administer community solar and what they're calling shared commercial solar, and these projects can now be considerably larger. The community program solar can be up to 1 megawatt, and the shared commercial programs can be between 1 and 5 megawatts, very large systems compared to our larger systems now are in the 10 kW range. So we don't have anything quite like that right now. There's limitations to how much program owners can participants can get. There's limits. It used to be you would just get your kilowatt hours. Now there's limits based on percentage of recovery of your system. There's a lot of moving parts. I'm not going to get to all the details because we're still analyzing. We can sure report on this later. Program's changing quite a bit going forward. Still need interconnection requirements or interconnection agreements between us and the customers. That's good. And they've also added the ability for what they're calling community solar providers. They can be third-party owners of these community systems. As I read the language now, and again, this is one of the things we'll have to dig through, that we could offer community solar. These other providers could come in. They would be registered with the UTC, and they would, in essence, be regulated by the UTC. But they would offer community solar to our customers. So that one, again, is going to take quite a bit more time as we walk through it to understand what's the basis of what do we want to do with this, opt-in, et cetera. Staff still has to review and analyze this bill. Any questions on that? I know it's a quick overview of much considerable aspects of this bill to still be reviewed and reported on.
Commissioners, any questions?
I have a couple more just on that one. I just wanted to spend a little bit more time on that if there was any questions. Then other bills of note, there was an aquatic invasive species bill we've been supporting, working on. It did pass. The major funding aspect of that was vetoed by, was taken out as an amendment, at the end before it was signed by the legislature. But it still provides for some new fees that will help fund Department of Fish and Wildlife's efforts to reduce aquatic invasive species into the state. That's a positive move forward for us. The Public Works Assistance Account, this was the Public Works Trust Fund bill. This was a major effort by the Public Works Board. We were heavily involved. We've talked about this quite a bit with the Tri-Commission. A bill did go forward. at this point, and that's a positive move forward. It will change how they establish funding mechanisms or funding and loans for public works. They do now, they've been given the authority to offer grants, they being the public works board. Again, through many of these things, rulemaking is going to settle out how will these things look as in practice. It's unclear, as I read this right now, how a project like Dryden would get funding. I could read it as it'd be up to their discretion. Could be a grant, could be a low interest loan. There's some very prescriptive approaches on how the board would set loans, but those are for systems that have over 50,000 ratepayers, and so we don't have any of our water systems that fall into that. City of Wenatchee doesn't fall into that. So I read that as meaning there's flexibility around how the loans will be determined. I think we'll spend some time and do a little more investigation and find out how would this impact our systems going forward, whether it be our wastewater systems or water systems.
Sean, so help me understand this. Did they sweep the funds for this year and then this work is in the plans for the following years, or?
So part of the legislation was that they ended some of the sweeps. So some of the money going to the education legacy account is now ended. They've retained some of the other tax flows, the basis of taxes that they were getting, and the real estate excise tax, that has been reestablished. And they're also going to be able to get the repayments back into the fund. So going forward, the fund's going to rebuild at this point. The people on the board that I spoke to felt positive about the revenue going forward. There's a current list of projects that they want to fund, and those are in a capital project and capital budget that hasn't been approved at this point. I'll talk about that here in a second, though, too, a little bit more about the capital budget. So it's positive for the Public Works Trust Fund. One of the things we wanted to see was a sustainable, reliable source. This has been a step towards that. The governor did veto one section of that bill, which would have brought legislators onto the board. And I'd have to understand why, but he just vetoed that section. I shared an information on a revenue bill earlier with some staff, but it turns out Amy Smith looked at this, and it had to do with the public utility privilege tax. It was just changing the date of reporting, and for some reason, the section of the Title 54 was related to thermal generation. And so very specific, I think the only thermal generation plant within PUDs is probably Clark County Public Utilities River Road plant. So I'm not sure what that's about, but we're not impacted by that section. The other bills that passed earlier were signed by the governor earlier. We talked about the unit price contract, and that was way back in April 20th. It seems like it was an eternity ago. We talked about that at a previous meeting. It was one of our bills that the PUDs were promoting that's in place. There was a bill related to improving public records administration. This doesn't change anything in the Public Records Act, as such as when we have to report and time and reporting, but it's more of an administrative bill looking at training for public records officers. They're going to do a study on a portal for public records requests, and I just sent this off to Katie Hunt to take a look over to understand how broad would that portal be. It's not clear to me would that apply to the state, or could it be a portal for any public records requests? And I'm not sure they understand yet the way the legislation was written, but it's to do a study on that. One of the issues in the operating budget, this is the one that was passed at the last minute to ensure the state government continued to operate. There was a proviso for the Utility and Transportation Commission to do a study on the best practices for developing distributed energy resource planning for utilities. That report's going to be due at the end of this year. This is something that's been pushed, particularly by the House Energy Committee, Representative Morris. It seems that this is the way they got it. They're going to take a look at what would distributed generation or distributed energy resource planning look like for utilities. So more information on that as that develops. But again, that's going to be commissioned and done by the UTC. One of the last items that we were looking over was the capital budget. And at this point, there was a budget that was approved that extends current programs, and they haven't approved a capital budget for new programs. Our centennial grant funding for the Peshawson project is under that ladder project, that ladder capital budget, and they haven't approved that yet. I mentioned the Public Works Trust Fund projects. Those are in this new. These are new money requests. And at this point, they could either, they're working on some discrepancies or debates about the HRSA funding or the HRSA fix, and that was related to exempt wells and how to go forward with dealing with this, the restrictions on exempt wells. That seems to be the negotiating that's taking place right now. But if they do not pass this the supplemental capital budget during this special session, we won't have that centennial grant funding in place for the Pashastun project. So the opportunities are they pass it now, or they go into another special session, or they wait till 2018. The governor has indicated he is not willing to go into yet another special session, a fourth special session. So we're waiting to see. They're still in session. They could still be working on that in this session. We'll know more as this develops. The other thing that you heard that came out that was mentioned today, there was one on the, there was a revenue bill that was set out there, and there was a couple sections of those were vetoed by the governor. Those had to do with the manufacturing B&O tax that was reduced going in and out years. He vetoed that section. And that, we'll see how that plays out. Just read an article in the Seattle Times about this. There's some feeling that that was some part of the negotiated deal that was then pulled back. So we're not sure what that looks like other than it changes the manufacturing B&O tax. It keeps the current tax in place instead of doing a reduction of that over time. The other one he vetoed was a section that was going to provide tax exemptions to encourage converting coal-fired plants to natural gas. And the rationale for his vetoing that section is that these, that TransAlta, basically, it's already in place to transition TransAlta, and this would be another incentive on top of that. That was be above the original agreement. Since they're still in session, we may have more to report later, but that's what we know of as of today. Any questions? We'll spend more time analyzing some of these bills we talked about. They're somewhat hot off the press. We've had time to look over them, but if we have anything else, we'll be back.
Great. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
And we saved the best for last. I want to ask Debbie Litchfield to come up to talk about debt reduction program.
Both.
Perfect.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Debbie Litchfield, Treasurer, and I am happy to be reporting to you today under the manager's items that we have achieved our $52 million of budgeted net debt reduction for 2017 with our scheduled and accelerated principal payments that occurred through July 1st of this year. We're pleased to have achieved this important milestone as part of our strategic plan. The debt outstanding is forecasted at year-end to be about $537 million, and we still have one small payment to make in October for about $130,000. This reduction will put our debt ratio at about 38%, which is right in line with our strategic plan of lowering our debt ratio to less than 35% by 2019, which is one year earlier than what we had initially anticipated that we would be doing when we set those policies in place. That was the 35% by 2019. That's assuming that we continue with our current debt reduction plan that we have in place. And this would bring our 2019 debt outstanding to about $370 million, which would be a debt ratio of 27%. As we continue to refine our financial forecast and we see that there are variables that continue to change with the forward price curve and the discussions around the facilities plan, among other actions, we may be proposing to you that we might want to look at the accelerated debt program that we have for 2018 and for 2019 while still being able to maintain our goal of achieving less than 35% by 2019. So that will be contingent upon. As we get more of this information, we'll continue to evaluate whether the current debt reduction program for 2018 and 19 continues to make sense. Right now, the current plan still pencils out that economically it makes sense to do those reductions, but we are actively and continuously managing our debt portfolio to ensure that we adapt to those current conditions as they arise. This achievement reflects our values of stewardship, which is especially financial stewardship, as aligning with our customer owners and the priority to reduce debt that we heard from them. Also, trustworthiness that demonstrates our integrity by doing what we said we were going to do. And also operational excellence in that by simplifying our debt portfolio and reducing some of this debt, create some efficiencies, and we have been able to, that's been demonstrated by our success of reducing one FTE within the Treasury Department since our debt reduction program was initiated. I do want to thank you for your consistent commitment to the debt reduction program and to the achievement of our financial policies and our goals. Any questions or comments?
Outstanding.
Yep, absolutely.
Good job.
Good news.
Yep. Yeah, wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, thanks.
That's it for our manager's report. So we could go through the additional commissioner action items and our follow-up action items if you'd like.
We have time. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
We have time. I think so. Any commissioner items?
Nope. Nope.
That was quick.
Maybe we didn't hold that one. I only have one. Well, I have two, actually. So first of all, the follow-up action items from the last meeting. Eric got all of them with respect to following up on the delegated authority resolution. He'll be working with you in one-on-ones and coming back formally in roughly a month or so.
Right. My plan, if we can get through all of the issues and questions, would be first of August, first meeting of August. If we can't do that, it might be the second.
And that was it for action items from the last meeting. And for action items from this meeting, I've got one. And that was basically a rule of thumb for percentage. If you did a percentage rate increase, how much revenue does that produce?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that was it.
So I might just say for the afternoon, we do have some executive session items. I think we would probably ask for an hour. Since we would be doing that, I wasn't sure how far we would get this morning, but because we've done so well, at 1 o'clock, we would I propose that we do the consent agenda, probably get that out of the way relatively quickly. So
yes.
The first time since I've been here, we have no resolutions today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So consent agenda, and then we would immediately go into executive session.
Okay.
Should be done by 2 o'clock, 2:15.
We want to do commissioner travel at that time, or do we have time to do it now?
Oh, actually, we could do it now.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm sorry, I missed that. So.
Hey, commissioners, I'm Lisa Sanders, admin and finance. Go over your travel. We have Commissioner Congdon traveling tomorrow. Commissioner Smith returns from his traveling on the 12th and then has some APPA trip on the 17th. Then we have WAPUDA meetings in Ocean Shores July 19th. And Commissioner Arsenault, I'll make the change you sent me this morning.
Thank you.
I had these printed already.
Thanks.
For July 25 and 26, Commissioner Bowles, I'll work on that this afternoon.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Then we're into September with WAPUDA at Douglas PUD. Nothing for specific individual committee meetings that I have right now. NWPPA in October for Commissioner Congdon. Energy Northwest, October 27-28. Looks like Commissioner Congdon is not attending. We have WAPUTA meetings in November and the WAPUTA annual conference end of November. And Water Committee meeting for Commissioner Congdon sometime in December.
WAPUTA's in Spokane, is that correct? November. Do I have that right?
The 15th?
Yes.
I have it.
I think it's Olympia.
In
Spokane, November.
The annual conference in December, on December 1st will be in Spokane.
Oh, that's what I was thinking about. Thank you.
Anything else?
This is really clear.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Clean.
Thank you.
Nice.
Glad to help.
Very helpful.
Yep.
Good.
Just before I break, to a quick update to say that we are doing all that we know how to do in terms of contacting the customers who might be impacted by the water restrictions, phone calls, door knocks, anything that we can think of there. So just trying to be active on that, and the media advisory, I'm thinking, has already gone out by now.
Yeah, I was thinking that could involve Chateau for LaFont and restaurant operation. Yep.
I missed that. Did you say the telemetry was down?
Yes.
So we didn't pick up on the fact that the reservoir was dropping?
Right. That's what we know. So let me just say that's what we think at the moment. I think full lessons learned will take a couple of days to pull together.
So with all the water coming in and all the water everywhere else, why is our reservoir dropping? We don't know.
Well, it's just that the telemetry went down, so there wasn't notification to... I'm sorry. So we're talking about not Rocky Reach. We're talking about a water reservoir, the tank, basically, for commercial and residential water supply.
So, and because the telemetry went down, we didn't do what?
So the tank drained, basically, without notification. So the pump didn't turn on I need to pump more water up into the reservoir.
Thank you. I missed that somehow.
Yeah. Actually, I have to admit, when I first got here on the term reservoir, it took me a good year to get used to the idea that a reservoir was a tank up on a hill.
Thank you, because I'm thinking, I don't know where this reservoir is.
So how quickly did we pick up on the fact that the telemetry, how did we find that out, that it was not functioning properly?
I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, it seems like you would get some sort of an alarm or some sort of an alert that,
I think what happened is customers started to call and say, wait a second, the water's not working today. But I don't know that for sure.
We should have some sort of an alert or something, I would
think. Well, we generally do, so there's some.
Yeah, so there's an issue what the telemetry should do. And then there's a backup, too. So a whole bunch of questions about why the telemetry not work, why the backup not work. A whole bunch we need to work through. But first priority is notification to customers, protecting public health, focusing on that. And we'll get to the how do we fix the problem.
Yeah.
And we do have people on the ground knocking on doors.
That's what I'm told.
Okay.
Yeah, that personal contact is really good.
Yeah.
Important.
Okay. Well, I don't see any public in the audience, but an additional public comment. So what we're going to do is we're going to close the morning session. We'll come back at 1 o'clock, and we'll have our regular session. At that time, we will do our consent, and then we will move shortly after that into executive session. So we will take a one-hour break for lunch.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the July 10th, 2017 business session, Schlenk County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us.
And no longer a quorum.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the consent agenda as presented.
Second.
Here a second.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Are there any discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor of signifying by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The ayes have it. Motion is carried. I will now move down to the conclusion of the regular agenda. We have a need for an executive session. Executive session will last about approximately 1 hour. Discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation, which the district is or its board is or is likely to become a party and or legal risks as authorized by RCW 42.30.110, parentheses 1, parentheses I, and to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by RCW 42.30.110, parentheses 1, parentheses G, and to consider the selection of a site or acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of increased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.110, parentheses 1, parentheses B. We are coming out of executive session. It is July 10th, 2017. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.